Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Wednesday, April 10th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Patty Daniels, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here's our first story. Patty will kick us off.
Thanks, Rachel. From the front page of the Quad City Times, school shooter's parents' sentence. Written for us by Ed White of the Associated Press. Pontiac, Michigan. The first parents convicted in a U.S. mass school shooting were sentenced to at least 10 years in prison Tuesday, as a Michigan judge lamented missed opportunities that could have prevented their teenage son from possessing a gun and killing four students in 2021. These convictions are not about poor parenting, Oakland County Judge Cheryl Matthews said. These convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train. The hearing in a crowded, tense courtroom was the climax of an extraordinary effort to make others, in addition to the 15-year-old attacker, criminally responsible for a school shooting. Jennifer and James Crumley did not know Ethan Crumley had a handgun in a backpack when he was dropped off at Oxford High School, but prosecutors convinced jurors the parents still played a disastrous role in the violence. The Crumleys were accused of not securing the newly purchased gun at home and acting indifferently to signs of Ethan's deteriorating mental health, especially when confronted with a chilling classroom drawing earlier the same day. The Crumleys were convicted this year of involuntary manslaughter. "The blood of our children is on your hands, too," Craig Schilling said during Tuesday's sentencing hearing, wearing a hoodie with the image of his son Justin Schilling on his chest. Nicole Bosoli, the mother of shooting victim Madison Baldwin, told the Crumleys they failed at parenting. "While you were purchasing a gun for your son and leaving it unlocked," said Bosoli, one of a handful of Oxford family members who spoke in court, "I was helping her finish her college essays." Prosecutor Carrie McDonald asked the judge to stretch beyond the sentencing guidelines and order a minimum 10-year prison sentence. Defense attorneys sought to keep the Crumleys out of prison, noting they already spent nearly 2.5 years in jail after failing to meet a $500,000 bond following their arrest. They will get credit for that jail time and become eligible for parole after serving at least 10 years in custody. If release from prison is denied, they could be held up for 15 years. Five deputies in the suburban Detroit courtroom stood closely over the couple, and more lined the walls. James Crumley, 47, was recorded in jail making threats toward McDonald. Before being sentenced, he stood and insisted he did not know his son was deeply troubled. "My heart is really broken for everybody involved. I have cried for you and the loss of your children more times than I can count," he said. The couple had separate trials in Oakland County Court, 40 miles north of Detroit. Jurors saw the teen's violent drawing on his school assignment and heard testimony about the crucial hours before the attack. Ethan Crumley sketched images of a gun, a bullet, and a wounded man on a math paper, accompanied by despondent phrases, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me. Blood everywhere. My life is useless." Ethan told a counselor he was sad. A grandmother died and his only friend suddenly moved away, but said the drawing only reflected his interest in creating video games. His parents were called to a hasty meeting at school that lasted less than 15 minutes. They did not mention that the gun resembled one James Crumley had purchased just 4 days earlier, a Sig Sauer 9mm. School staff did not demand that Ethan go home, but were surprised when the Crumleys did not volunteer it. Instead, they left with a list of mental health providers and said they were returning to work.
The next article on the front page is titled, Just Go For It, and it's accompanied by a photograph of Abby Peters of Snake Farm Creative showing off a jacket made of vintage upholstery material in her home in Eldridge. She specializes in making bold and colorful Western designs. This is by Gretchen Teske of the Quad City Times. The house on 4th Street in Eldridge looks like any other home in its quiet neighborhood. A green front porch welcomes visitors through a solid wood door where cowboy boots are lined up all the way to the staircase. Going up the carpeted stairs leads to a series of bedrooms, one painted bright orange. At first glance, the room looks like any other, but on second glance, shelves stacked with piles of fabric catch the eye. A large table in the corner of the room holds cups of pens, pencils, scissors, and other tools. Sewing machines are stashed under it for storage, and a basket of rolled-up papers sits beside it. More cowboy boots and other clothing peek out from the open closet, and a clothing rack near the door is filled with shirts, dresses, and jackets, all lined with fringe, rhinestones, and custom appliques. The bed, neatly tucked into the corner, is a reminder that when the room isn't being used as a studio for custom country western wear, it's also the childhood bedroom of Abby Peters, who says she stumbled into her new career completely by accident. Peters grew up with two grandmothers who sewed often and encouraged the hobby in their grandchildren. The first thing she hand-sewed with her grandmother was a teddy bear, gingerbread man style, with cheetah print fabric. It still sits in the orange room. In junior high, Peters leveled up when an aunt gifted her a very heavy, very temperamental Singer machine from the 60s that she got at a garage sale. I didn't really touch that machine all that much after I first got it, just because it was hard to use. But I would pull it out in college and make Halloween costumes, she said. But I really got into sewing after the Peace Corps. Peters was volunteering in Mozambique, a country in Southeast Africa, when she started growing frustrated with her limited clothing options due to the climate, cultural norms, and seeing all the clothing waste that ends up in developing countries. Once her 27-month-long service ended in 2018, she moved on to Haiti, where she worked as a social worker through the nonprofit Serve Haiti. During her time abroad, Peters lived mostly out of a backpack and became accustomed to a minimalist lifestyle. As the socio-political situation in Haiti heated up, she decided to move back home to Eldridge in early 2020. Seeing the amount of clothing and items she had at home overwhelmed her, and she began donating a vast majority, forgetting she'd moved back to a four seasons climate. As seasons changed, Peters was in need of new clothes. Wanting to keep her carbon footprint low, she began checking out resale shops. I was spending a lot of time at thrift stores and realized they have a lot of fabric there too, she said. I dug into Instagram, finding independent pattern makers, designers, and pulling out that old sewing machine and seeing what I could do. Things got off to a decent start, and Peters began reteaching herself all the skills she learned as a child, but she could not shake the feeling that something was missing. Even though she was back home in her childhood hometown and home, it didn't feel quite right. At the same time, I was feeling frustrated with all of these things. I was feeling really frustrated with a sense of place and being back in Eldridge after being out of the country and looking for a way to make here feel like home in a way that felt authentic and good for me, she said. That started her on a path of digging into family genealogy and their Western roots. The original Peters family farm is a few miles away from where she lives now. As a child, she grew up riding horses with her great uncle, who always dressed his part. He would always wear pearl snaps with the embroidered yokes and bolo ties at family reunions, and his kids rodeoed, she said. There was just something in that in that I felt drawn back to, but also plenty of things in the Western industry that I didn't feel like I aligned with. Peters wanted to make sure her clothing was an extension of her journey to exploring her roots and understanding her family's history. Once the clothing started to come together, she created a business, Snake Farm Creative. Coming up with the name was the hardest part, she said, adding the inspiration came from the Ray Wiley Hubbard song, Snake Farm. In the countries she lived in and cultures she was immersed with, snakes were a big part of the landscape, and the reminder felt authentic and true to her journey thus far, she said. Historically, snakes being a symbol of the divine feminine, but also constantly shedding their skin, changing, evolving. On a lot of levels, there was something in it that felt right, she said. At the same time, Peters was still working for Serve Haiti remotely. While she was home, Peters began digging into the more intricate details of Western wear, like embroidery. She dug into chain stitch embroidery, which was popularized by Czech immigrants who came to the United States and observed the stitching in Western wear. There was a cultural crossover, with the migrants knowing how to do the work, and it surged in popularity. I wanted to be doing that because that is what I had been most exposed to, but it turns out chain stitch machines are very expensive, she said. So I started looking for other avenues and tried out leather. Accessorizing with leather appliques became popular in the early 30s, she said. It is most commonly seen in the designs stitched onto the clothing and cut into various shapes like horseshoes, spurs, and hats. With her newfound success, Peters began layering the fabrics to create dimensional designs and learned a life lesson along the way. It's been a really good lesson for me in terms of being able to do what you can with what you have, and those limitations often lend to something really interesting and can be very unlimited if you have the right mindset around it, she said. She created an Instagram page for her business and began sharing her creations. Friends of hers with businesses of their own began sharing her posts. One of those friends owns the company Mud Lowry, which specializes in custom jewelry and had connections in high places. He was doing a significant number of pieces for Miranda Lambert, a few things for Carrie Underwood, and handful of other artists, and working with their stylists, she said. He would name drop Peters to various stylists, and one day it paid off. Peters received a message on Instagram from a celebrity stylist who was inquiring about a custom garment. Originally, Peters thought the clothing would be for the stylist herself. We get to the end of the conversation and she says, "Okay, cool. It's actually for Miranda Lambert for this leg of her tour, so we will need it by this date," Peters said. In May 2022, Lambert and Little Big Town kicked off the bandwagon tour with Lambert wearing a custom maroon dress made by Peters. That November, Peters made another dress for Lambert to wear at the Country Music Awards during a tribute to country great Loretta Lynn, who died a month before the ceremony. The dress consisted of nearly 600 hand-set colored rhinestones and 76 individually drawn and hand-cut leather applique pieces. Collaborations have continued, and she has created more custom designs for Lambert, as well as other country artists like Caitlin Butts. Nearly everything Peters creates is custom and special, considering drawing and cutting the appliques alone takes about 12 hours, and construction of the garment as long as 8 hours. Sewing and creating continued to be a hobby until March 2023, when her work with Serve Haiti wrapped up. She considered looking into the social work realm again, but could not shake the feeling she was on the cusp of something great. I started thinking back on all the stories people have when they do something big. It happens out of a moment when they don't have any other options, she said. I thought I would just go for it and see what happens. That attitude is what has propelled her forward into success and keeps the orders coming in. For the most part, everything is custom, but it's all designed that way, she said. Peters operates under the philosophy that clothes should fit people and not the other way around. At the end of the day, what I don't want to do is make something just to make something, she said. I want these clothes to be loved and for people to feel like their best selves when they wear them, and not for the garments to just sit on a rack. With business booming, Peters has outgrown the orange bedroom on 4th Street and has her sights set on a new studio space in Eldridge. Doing all the work herself can be overwhelming, she admitted, but that feeling melts away once customers feel as good as the clothes look. It is truly a great feeling when somebody gets a garment and can feel that somebody made this from top to bottom and they put it on and it fits them so well. It's really incredible. And then I tend to forget every stressful thing that happened in the process, she said. It's all fine. And then I do it again.
Moline Coal Valley, school board votes to censure member. Written for us by Olivia Allen of the QC Times. The Moline Coal Valley School Board will censure fellow member Jason Farrell in wake of alleged dating app misconduct and ensuing public outcry facing the school district. In a vote with support from all members present, the board passed a formal resolution to censure Farrell at Monday's regular school board meeting. As you know, all video and audio information relating to Mr. Farrell has circulated widely online. The board has received an overwhelming amount of contacts and reports about it, Board President Andrew Weyert said. Mr. Farrell has stated that the video and audio of him have been falsified. The board and administration have invited him to share any such evidence to back this claim up, but he, for alleged personal legal reasons, has declined to do so. As previously reported, Matthew Harris, the ex-husband of Farrell's wife, claims Farrell has been pretending to be him, including pretending to be a veteran on Tinder. He detailed the accusations in a YouTube video titled, Moline Coal Valley School Board Member Pretends to be Military Veteran on Tinder. Farrell has denied the allegations. Multiple community members spoke in support of Farrell's removal during Monday's public comment, including relatives of Harris. His father, John Harris, said the alleged impersonation disrespected real soldiers and veterans. Joe Schilling spoke next, sharing his experience facing alleged harassment, which he claimed stems from a political disagreement from Farrell and his wife, specifically impacting his family business, St. Giuseppe's Pizza. Jason has desperately tried to make a villain out of me and my business, and he has desperately tried to hurt my reputation in the community, he said. Regardless of politics, I find that absolutely disgusting. The second section of the resolution states that video and or audio evidence concerning Farrell's alleged conduct has led to public outcry calling for Farrell's resignation or removal on the school board. We are not a court or jury, but the alleged conduct is so deeply disturbing, and it has resulted in the district being cast in a terrible light. The board and administration have been inundated with inquiries, complaints, and FOIA requests about this matter, and it has monopolized all of our time, Weyert said. This situation and its impact have taken away countless hours from our mission, which is to serve kids and families. The resolution cites Moline Coal Valley Board Policies 280, Board Member Oath and Conduct, and 260, Board Member Removal from Office, as the rationale behind Farrell's censure. Per policy 280, if a majority of the Moline Coal Valley School Board determines that a fellow member has willfully failed to perform his or her official duties, they may request the regional superintendent with the Rock Island County Regional Office of Education to remove such member from office. The board has attempted to give Mr. Farrell the opportunity to present any evidence in his defense, the resolution states. After receiving no such evidence and after due consideration of all the evidence available at this time, and in light of the urgency of this matter, the board finds it necessary and desirable to take immediate action. Now, RIROE will determine the next steps of Farrell's potential removal. He did not attend Monday's meeting. In a statement to the Dispatch, Argus, and or Quad City Times last week, he said he did not intend to resign and that he and his wife were consulting legal counsel on how to respond to the accusations. To watch Monday's board meeting in full, visit the Moline Television YouTube channel for a live streamed recording.
Estonian Defense Minister visits region. This is by Olivia Allen and is accompanied by a photograph of Estonian Minister of Defense Hanno Pevkur, who is speaking to a class at Augustana College. Estonian Defense Minister Hanno Pevkur visited the Quad Cities on Tuesday as part of a nationwide tour to promote foreign policy relationships between Europe and the United States. He is making several stops in Iowa and Illinois from April 7th through 10th for the German Marshall Fund's Across America initiative, which seeks to engage public, private, and nonprofit leaders across the U.S. at both state and local levels on transatlantic issues and other international affairs, to identify shared interests and policy priorities and build global connections. Pevkur was in Des Moines on Monday, meeting with state officials, including Governor Kim Reynolds. They spoke about the urgency of passing federal legislation to continue providing aid to Ukraine as it continues to fight against the Russian invasion, Pevkur said. Federal aid to Ukraine has been held up in the Republican-led House of Representatives as Speaker Mike Johnson has navigated fractious caucuses in his party. A contingent of far-right House Republicans are staunchly opposed to additional Ukraine funding, while other Republicans are pushing for the legislation to be brought to the floor. Some lawmakers are seeking support for a rare discharge petition, which would force a vote on the funding package. It's not only Ukraine fighting for Ukraine and Ukrainians. They're fighting for our values, Pevkur said. For U.S. values, for Estonian values. Reynolds and Pevkur also spoke about Estonia's effort to move the vast majority of its social service administration online, he said. He said Estonians can apply for nearly all services online, other than marriage and divorce. Pevkur's visit to Iowa included a tour of LMT Defense, a company in Eldridge that manufactures rifles for the Estonian military. The country has purchased 20,000 rifles from the company, Pevkur said, with the possibility of more in the future. The company moved to Eldridge from Milan, Illinois in 2019. When LMT brought the factory to Iowa because of Estonia, then that means that Estonia brought jobs to Iowa, Pevkur said. On Tuesday, Pevkur visited the LMT facility in Eldridge, but first, he spoke to Professor Zhaowen Zhang's political science class at Augustana College. You are the future decision makers, he said to the class. He opened by giving an overview of Estonia's history, focusing on its occupation under the Soviet Union and wars for independence. You lose everything under occupation, Pevkur said, using this historical context to segue into Estonia's support for Ukraine against Russia. He urged continued U.S. support on this front, also speaking about the importance of maintaining transatlantic partnerships, namely NATO, and upholding treaty obligations regardless of who U.S. voters elect as the next president. We are the watchdogs of democracy together, Pevker said. Using NATO and other European allies' support of the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan as an example, we are fighting for the same freedoms. When you have good friends and allies, you can do great things. To him, the global fight against dictatorship spans far past Russia's invasion of Ukraine and is a matter the U.S. and its foreign allies should address fervently, he said. I really believe that the more we have people who understand the global situation and why it's important to keep the peace, the more possibility we have to better develop diplomacy, Pevker said after the class, and the more stability we have to keep peace in the world. This kind of global lens, he said, goes beyond modern-day wars and conflicts and includes religion, economy, language, and cultures overall. It's important to have that discussion, particularly with political science students, Pevker said, because I might have one view, but also it is important to understand what the students are thinking. After finishing his remarks, Pevker held a question and answer session with the students. Oliver Michalik, a senior history major from Wheaton, Illinois, asked about technology's impact on national security and defense planning, noting continued cyber threats facing nations, entities, and industries across the globe. Obviously, we learn a lot from in textbooks and whatnot, and that's fine, but to actually hear someone from another country working in their government was super interesting, he said, noting it was especially interesting to hear Pevker's perspective on Russia and the war in Ukraine. Michalik said he was also surprised to learn about Estonia's cultural erasure during Soviet occupation. I've always found it interesting how these countries who were occupied by the Soviet Union, like Estonia, seek to move away from Russia and join NATO to adopt a more democratic form of government, he said. Through the Across America Initiative, German Marshall Fund works to reaffirm the legacy of the Marshall Plan and former U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson's famous nationwide tour. Acheson's tour aimed to communicate the importance of Europe's post-World War II recovery for U.S. vital interests in political and economic stability, and promoting human freedom and democratic institutions to the American public. This was written by Caleb McCullough, contributed to by Caleb McCullough of the Lee Des Moines Bureau, also on this report. It is almost time to move to the obituaries. Let's see if we can find one very short article. Moline Police Seek Robbery Suspect by Anthony Watt. Moline Police have asked for help identifying a person suspected of robbing a tobacco store on Tuesday. The robbery happened around noon at Greenleaf Tobacco and Vape at 3824 44th Avenue Drive, according to Moline Police Department. The male robber entered the store, stole merchandise, and threatened an employee. The threat involved the robber telling the employee not to call police or he would shoot her, the police department said. No gun was displayed, but the robber did infer he had one. The robbery did not result in any injuries, the department said. After taking the property, the robber fled on foot, according to the department. The police released a photo of the person suspected of being the robber. The photo shows a black male with shoulder-length hair, wearing jeans, white tennis shoes, and a blue jacket. As the suspect has not been charged yet, the dispatch, Argus Quad City Times, has decided not to run the photo. Anyone with information about the incident is asked to contact the police department at 309-797-0401. Or Crime Stoppers at 309 765 9,500, according to the police. They can also use the P3 Tips app. Just a reminder, you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And it is time to turn, to the obituaries. I'll read the pendings, Patty, if you'll read the two obituaries that are at the top of the page. Services pending include the Reverend Canon Gary Dalmasso, age 81, of Silvis, Illinois. Arrangements pending at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home. Bonnie Doppler, age 65, of East Moline. Arrangements at Van Ho Funeral Home. Gary or Gus Dumeroff, age 70, of Davenport, who died Monday, April 8th. Arrangements pending at the Runge Mortuary. Brian J. Hoftender, age 58, of Muscatine, died Sunday, April 7th. Arrangements pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory of Milan. Judy Kuntz, age 87, of Maquoketa, died Tuesday, April 9th at Maquoketa Care Center. Arrangements pending at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. William R. Platt, age 49, of Davenport, died April 7th. Cremation will be directed by Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Mark A. Rockwell, age 76, of Galena, and formerly of Maquoketa, died Friday, April 5th. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Mary L. Schulte, age 73, of Davenport, died on April 3rd. Arrangements are pending at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home. James C. Stewart, age 86, of Silvis, died on Monday, April 8th. Arrangements are pending at Van Ho Funeral Home in East Moline. And Sally Ann Vandevoort, age 85, of Madison, Wisconsin, formerly of Moline, died on Tuesday, April 9th. Arrangements pending at Rafferty Funeral Home in Moline.
Dorothy A. Cole. A memorial gathering for Dorothy A. Cole, 94, a resident of Princeton, Iowa, will be from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday, April 14th, at the McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Memorials may be made to Heartland Hospice. Dorothy died on Thursday, March 14th, at Jersey Ridge Place in Davenport. To view her entire obituary and leave condolences for the family, please visit www.mcginnischambers.com. Bettendorf. Bernard B.K. Martin, October 27, 1935 to April 7th. 2024. Bernard B.K. Martin, 88, of Bettendorf, passed away peacefully on Sunday, April 7th, at his home where he wanted to be, with his loving family at his side. A celebration of B.K.'s life will be held on Monday, April 15th, from 1 to 3 p.m., with a luncheon and time of fellowship to follow. Military honors will be held on Tuesday, April 16th, at 11 a.m. at Davenport Memorial Park. Those wishing to attend are asked to meet at Weird's Funeral Home at 10:30 a.m. B.K. was born on October 27, 1935, in Illinois City, Illinois, the third son of Charles Maynard and Josephine Alvina Danner Martin. He attended elementary school in Illinois City and went to high school in Taylor Ridge. Following high school, he worked for the Village of Milan Public Works Department. B.K. joined the U.S. Army on November 9, 1954, with his buddy Kenny Gastel. He served in the European theater during the Korean conflict. He was honorably discharged on November 8, 1957. Shortly after being discharged, he met Phyllis May Patkunas at the Muscatine Roller Skating Rink. They later married on November 7, 1958 at the First Methodist Church in Muscatine. Their marriage was later blessed at St. Pius Catholic Church in Rock Island. He was a truck driver for Motor Cargo, Consolidated Freightways, and Darn Transfer. From 1981 to 2002, he owned and operated B.K. Martin Trucking, Rock Island. He was a hard worker and well-liked by everyone that he worked with. He had a wonderful sense of humor. B.K. loved his family and was a loving husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. He enjoyed following NASCAR racing, working on cars, displaying HO trains, gardening, traveling, and helping others. B.K. was a proud American and a big supporter of the disabled American veterans. Survivors include his wife of 65 years, Phyllis, daughter Judith Ann Donald Lance, that spouse Donald Lance Ewing, grandchildren Jessica Wasson, Jennifer and Justin, and six great grandchildren. His brothers Charles and Merrill, and his three male cats Snowball, Bandit, and Cheddar. He was preceded in death by his parents and a great-granddaughter, Catherine May Hollis. Online condolences may be expressed to the Martin family by visiting BK's obituary at www.wiersfh.com. And one more, this is not local. Scientist Peter Higgs dies at age 94. Written for us by Benigna Kirka, Jill Lawless, and Jamie Keaton of the Associated Press. London. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Peter Higgs, who proposed the existence of the God particle that helped explain how matter formed after the Big Bang, has died at age 94, the University of Edinburgh said Tuesday. The university where Higgs was emeritus professor said he died Monday following a short illness. Higgs predicted the existence of a new particle which became known as the Higgs boson in 1964. He theorized there must be a subatomic particle of certain dimension that would explain how other particles, and therefore all the stars and planets in the universe, acquired mass. Without something like this particle, the set of equations physicists use to describe the world, known as the Standard Model, would not hold together. Higgs' work helped scientists understand one of the most fundamental riddles of the universe, how the Big Bang created something out of nothing 13.8 billion years ago. Without mass from the Higgs, particles could not clump together into the matter we interact with every day. It took almost 50 years for the particle's existence to be confirmed. In 2012, one of the biggest breakthroughs in physics in decades, scientists at CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, announced they finally found a Higgs boson using the Large Hadron Collider, the 10 billion-dollar atom smasher, in a 17-mile tunnel under the Swiss-French border. The collider was designed in large part to find Higgs particle. It produces collisions with extraordinarily high energies in order to mimic some of the conditions that were present in the trillions of seconds after the Big Bang. Higgs won the 2013 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work, alongside François Englert of Belgium, who independently came up with the same theory.
It's time to turn to the opinion page of the Quad City Times. The first opinion piece, written by State Auditor Rob Sand, "Iowans Must Stand with Victims." He writes, "Lots of topics get swept under the rug because they're not comfortable for us to confront. Sometimes we'd rather pretend the problems don't exist or couldn't happen in a place like Iowa, but they do. And it can happen anywhere, even in our great state. It is our obligation to confront them in order to solve them. I've always spoken out on behalf of victims of sexual violence. From my time as a prosecutor putting or keeping rapists and pedophiles behind bars, to voting against taxpayer-funded settlements that bail out perpetrators of egregious sexual harassment in my role as a member of the State Appeal Board, now that I'm state auditor. The month of April marks Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The National Sexual Violence Resource Center provides a number of tools to help raise awareness of sexual assault and prevent it from happening in the first place. So let's confront another uncomfortable topic. Since her term began, Iowa's Attorney General Brenna Byrd cut off funding for emergency contraception for rape victims. It is hard to believe, but read that sentence again. The majority of the program's participants are Iowa children and teenagers. This has nothing to do with abortion. Emergency contraception, in fact, must be taken quickly after a rape to prevent pregnancy. Her refusal to support rape victims literally makes my skin crawl. In addition to avoid accountability, the Attorney General is claiming there is an audit underway. I'm her auditor. That's not true. She might be having someone in her office concoct some twisted memo to try to justify her decision, but that's not an audit. Protecting victims and providing support for people who've experienced an unspeakable crime shouldn't be a partisan idea. Political considerations didn't cross my mind when I was prosecuting sex offenders at the Attorney General's office, and for the vast majority of hardworking people in law enforcement, that's still true. But the Attorney General's decision to stop providing payments for emergency contraception is exactly that. It reminds me of why so many Iowans turn away from politics and how we hate what it does to people who seek power. The Attorney General says she's unsure whether taxpayer funds should be used for this purpose, except the funds weren't coming from taxes. The money comes from fines paid by offenders found guilty of crimes. Iowans are fair-minded. We want justice for those wronged. During Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we should all recommit ourselves to finding care and consideration for people who have been through trauma and tragedy. The Attorney General should stop hiding behind make-believe audits and political games and restore funding for emergency contraception. To learn more about Sexual Assault Awareness Month and ways you can help prevent this crime from happening, visit nsvrc.org. Again, that by Rob Sand, the State Auditor of Iowa.
Thank you, Rachel. The Total Eclipse of Donald Trump, written for us by Robert Reich. I have this recurring fantasy that Trump will disappear forever. Monday's total solar eclipse isn't a perfect analogy because Trump doesn't shine like the sun and the moon will block the sun only temporarily. But for a few blissful minutes, anyone who happened to be in the path of Monday's eclipse experienced an elation more intense than any other celestial experience. It's only a matter of time before we experience the same exhilaration when Trump is gone, and he will be gone. Either he'll lose the 2024 election, or he'll be sent to jail, or both. Or he'll win and be president for a short time before becoming so blatantly and dangerously unhinged that even Republican lawmakers demand he step down. Eventually, of course, he will depart the celestial realm altogether, as we all will. He'll be 78 in June and doesn't look like he's in the best of shape. But Trump will also go into total eclipse because con artists are able to keep their cons going only if the cons get larger and more audacious. Trump's biggest con, his 2024 presidential campaign based on his big lie about the 2020 election, is about as big as a con as you can get. His smaller cons aren't doing well. Anyone who bought into Trump Media's initial public offering when it peaked at $79.38 a share is now 43% poorer. After it went public, Trump Media had to report it lost $58.2 million in 2023 on sales of just $4.1 million. This makes Trump Media almost worthless. Trump has also been selling copies of the King James Bible for $59.99 each. He's calling it the God Bless the USA Bible, and including the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, both of which are already in the public domain. Apparently, he's got few buyers. He's been hawking gold chocolate bars, wines, superhero NFTs, and Never Surrender sneakers for $399 a pair. None of these cons will do any better than Trump University, Trump Steaks, Trump Plaza, Trump Marina, or the Trump Taj Mahal. Like all fraudsters, Trump is running out of suckers. On Saturday night, Trump convinced 117 extraordinarily wealthy people to give him $50 million at a campaign fundraiser at the Palm Beach home of billionaire investor John Paulson. They believe that if Trump becomes president again, he'll give them another big tax cut. But the only way to finance another big tax cut without exploding the federal budget deficit would be to cut Social Security and Medicare, which Trump now promises he won't do. So either Trump's billionaire backers are being conned or the American people are. So prepare for Trump's total eclipse. Now, Robert Wright is a former U.S. Secretary of Labor. And he's a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. And his columns are syndicated by Tribune Content Agency.
There are several letters to the editor in today's paper, but I'll choose two that are local affiliated rather than national debates. Are LeClaire speed cameras about safety or money? I've never had the pleasure of visiting LeClaire, Iowa, so imagine how surprised I was when I received a civil citation from LeClaire's police department alleging that a car I owned had sped through their jurisdiction. When I appealed the citation, it became clear that I had to somehow prove that I wasn't in Iowa at the time of the citation. Eventually, the city recognized their system had failed and dropped the citation. I had since moved on and had forgotten about the inconvenience. However, I recently received notification that my personal information had been compromised through the city's arrangement with viewcitation.com. This is an online site that the public is required to use to review and contest the citation. The city contends that the speed cameras are to reduce speed-related incidents in high-risk areas. 3 years into this experiment, the city has yet, as far as I can ascertain, to release any data that supports that claim. The city has, however, often discussed how to utilize the funds generated from the speed cameras. Take a look at the PowerPoint shared at the city's February 20th, 2024, by Dennis Bockenstedt, city administrator, who was discussing fiscal year 2025 revenue. Along with the taxes residents pay, the income from the speed cameras is listed. One could reasonably assume that this may not genuinely be about public safety, but it is certainly a way to generate revenue from residents and visitors alike, and non-visitors in my case. Signed, Nathan Kearns of Howard, Ohio. And this from Paul Venaglia of Bettendorf. Iowa representatives not supporting Ukraine. Who'd have thought Ukraine's life and death struggle would be so hampered by Iowa's Republican representatives who have delayed for months sending defensive military hardware Ukraine needs to survive. So sad. So sad. Ukraine contracted with Russia and NATO to transfer Ukraine's nuclear arsenal for a promise that its borders would remain secure. Unfortunately, for corrupt adversaries like Putin and his puppets, contracts are meaningless against their tyrannical desires. So sad. While Ukraine experiences a 9/11 weekly, Those same Republicans use Ukraine's dire need as trading chips for U.S. domestic issues that Republicans can't negotiate and or legislate without leverage. That's the result of minority agendas clashing with a majority's belief. When terrorists attacked the United States, the responses by the United States and its allies were overwhelming. Yet Ukraine's war with a terrorist whose terror tactics are unimaginably beyond what the United States experienced becomes nuanced. Ukraine is an ally. Yet today's House Republicans sit on their hands and click their tongues as Ukraine's civilians endure deadly daily Russian aerial assaults. So sad. Ukraine needs military tools to defend themselves from invasion. Iowa workers make a lot of those military tools and contribute to Iowa's economies across the state, especially eastern Iowa. Republicans claim pragmatic leadership as one of their strengths. So supporting Iowa's economy and supporting a new democracy should be a no-brainer. So sad. Iowa's four Republican representatives bear direct responsibility. When voting, keep in mind reasonable alternatives to Iowa's current Republican regime and consider making Iowa's ideals and representation great again. Again, that was written by Paul Venaglia of Bettendorf.
We have time for a little bit of sports. I think I'll just read some short articles. And here we have college basketball. Calipari officially leaves Kentucky. Lexington, John Calipari stepped down as Kentucky's men's basketball coach Tuesday after 15 years, saying that the program probably needs to hear another voice. Amid reports, he's closing in on a deal with Arkansas to take over that Southeastern Conference program. Calipari leaves a Wildcats program he guided to the 2012 NCAA championship among four Final Four appearances. He went 410 to 123 in 15 seasons. Ex-Jayhawks rape case dropped. Lawrence, Kansas. Prosecutors have dropped a felony rape case against former Kansas basketball player Arterio Morris. They cited insufficient evidence on Tuesday while filing a motion in Douglas County District Court to seek its dismissal without prejudice. Morris was charged last August and dismissed from the Jayhawks program after an incident report came to light detailing an alleged rape that occurred at McCarthy Hall, which houses the men's basketball team along with other residents. The criminal complaint alleged that a sexual assault involving an 18-year-old victim occurred on August 26. Morris was not named in the incident report, but he was subsequently suspended from the team and then dismissed. From the NFL, eight position helmets approved. Eight new position-specific helmets for quarterbacks and linemen have been approved by the NFL and the NFL Players Association. Two of the new models, manufactured by Riddell, are designed for quarterbacks, while six helmets are made for offensive and defensive linemen. Quarterbacks now have three choices of helmets, specifically designed for their position to help reduce concussions, including the Vichy's 0-2 Matrix QB that was introduced last year. The new models are Riddell's SpeedFlex Precision QB and the Axiom 3D QB. The Vichy's 0-2R Trench for offensive and defensive linemen was the first position-specific helmet introduced in 2022. And Chief Superfan must pay $10.8 million, Oklahoma City. An Oklahoma judge ordered a Kansas City Chiefs superfan known as Chiefsaholic to pay $10.8 million to a teller who was assaulted with a gun in a series of bank robberies the man admitted to committing. A judge in Tulsa handed down the order last week against Xavier Michael Boucher Bedar, 29, who is known for attending Chiefs game, dressed as a wolf in the NFL team's gear. Former bank teller Peyton Garcia alleged Bubadar used a gun to assault her during a robbery of a Bixby, Oklahoma credit union in December 2022, court records show. The judge ordered Bubadar to pay Garcia $3.6 million for her injuries and loss of income and $7.2 million in punitive damages. And one more. Soccer. Nayer Keys win for U.S. Columbus, Ohio. Alyssa Nayer made three saves in a penalty shootout and converted her own attempt to lead the United States past Canada in the final of the She Believes Cup, America's fifth straight title in the event. The U.S. won the shootout 5-4 after the rivals played to a 2-2 draw in regulation. Emily Fox scored the decisive goal in the seventh round of the shootout after Nair stopped Evelyn Vince. Sophia Smith scored both U.S. goals. And I'll read one more. Spanish player banned for 15 years. London, Spanish tennis player Aaron Cortez has been given a 15-year ban for match-fixing and other offenses. The International Tennis Integrity Agency says the 29-year-old Cortez admitted 35 breaches of the tennis anti-corruption program between 2016 and 2018. Cortez reached his highest singles ranking of number 955 in 2017. He has been banned from playing and coaching and even attending official tennis events until March 27, 2039.
That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. Your readers have been Patty Daniels, and my name is Rachel Miffelman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. And thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.